nation together, just like it did when Nelson Mandela was watching. It's an unhappy ending for England, but it's a famous final scene for South Africa. They have won this match, and in the end they've won it comprehensively. England 12, South Africa, the world champions, 32.
So there you have it. The moment that South Africa won the final, the Rugby World Cup final, though, to be honest, sort of 15, 20 minutes, or you could say more than 15, 20 minutes before that, the writing was kind of on the wall. They gave England a bit of a seeing to, if we're honest. We'll say we, which I say we, I certainly didn't foresee that. And I didn't hear many people saying the box were going to win comfortably. Lots of people are reasonably wise after the event.
I did.
You didn't.
In my head, I did.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, this is the ITV STV Rugby World Cup podcast with me, Di Flats, and him,
Tom Shanklin.
And this is our final pod, our final show podcast, our final cast after a truly mega tournament.
And well done to the Springboks. Commiserations to England. We have to say that. A quick reflection from you, Flats. Where was it won and lost?
On the pitch.
Yeah. I mean, not too much detail now because we're going to dissect this like a surgeon.
Yeah, of course we are. It doesn't take a lot of dissecting, does it? The best way to sum it up is Census Johnston, the great Samoan tight head. His tweet is the best way to sum up the final. No scrum, no win. Yeah? We'll discuss the day in a minute, but what was it like at Gaucho, Tommy boy?
Quiet.
Was it subdued? Ooh.
Yeah, there was probably 30 to 40 people there in the top room in Piccadilly Gaucho. Breakfast was amazing, by the way.
Was it?
Delicious. Yeah, steak and eggs. There was avocado on a bit of rye bread with poached egg on top. There was chorizo sausage. It was delicious with a pint of Guinness.
Oh, sweet. Well, because you're lads on tour, aren't you?
Well, and we drink responsibly. But there was a lot of English there, as you can imagine.
Thing is, though, people, we're going to talk about this in a minute, I expect. Non-English people listening to this pod, and there's loads of people who aren't English that listen to this pod. There's like four of them that we know of. They'll be thinking, oh, yeah, bet you were loving that being there watching England losing. But I bet, obviously, you're not upset because you wouldn't really care. But it's like, didn't make it a 10 times better day because England lost, did it? It's like it just actually ruins the event a little bit. It's just the way sport goes.
There was a table of four South Africans in the room. The rest were English. And, you know, I wanted England to win because, you know, more of my friends are English from Northern Hemisphere rugby as well.
You're basically English.
And you pick on form as well. And the form leading up to that game was two brilliant games from England, Australia and New Zealand. So, I mean, it was quite a quiet mood after. But to be honest, mate, nobody had any complaints after the game.
No.
It took everyone a little bit by surprise how good South Africa were. But, you know, from what it's done for the country and for inspiring youngsters, wow. And you only have to listen to Razi Erasmus after Khaleesi. You know, every South African, whether former player, I mean, what it's done for their country and the belief, and with everything going on there, it's just absolutely huge. And when you look at it like that, you think, rah, in terms of what it's going to do for a country, there is no better winner. I'm sorry, there isn't.
There isn't. And it's funny because you're all sort of basically cooped up in hotel rooms, aren't you, a lot of the time before big games, because you can't go out and party because you've got work to do the next day and you're in your room a lot. So I read one article and I can't remember who wrote it actually, otherwise I can't remember, but it was along the lines of, you know, I think it was like 4 or 5 years ago, and it's talking about, it's a black South African who lives in a township talking about being at, I think, the local inn to watch the game on a screen, and everyone in there, all the locals, are cheering on the team that are playing against South Africa.
Yeah.
Because they don't want South Africa to win, because they've got nothing in common with the South African rugby team. This is after 95. This is after 2007. So it doesn't just fix things. So there was still work to do. And you just think, what Siya Khaleesi doing, achieving what he's achieved, you know.
Mpipi as well.
Just fantastic. So what they've achieved is just hopefully has a lasting effect. It was a magnificent performance. Just beastly, to be honest.
Yeah, it was. Now, you've had a long tour of duty, mate. Probably the longest you've ever done as a player, as a pundit. How was your flight back home? Because that's important. And what was it like seeing, God, the Rugrats faces when he turned up at London Heathrow?
The flight back was all right.
Do you lie flat?
No, but I was really lucky because you're with ITV, you get properly looked after. You know, you're not running your own tour, basically. And it is really, your hand is held all the way around Japan. So don't really care where I sit, but an upgrade would be nice. And I ended up in premium economy with an exit seat.
Nice.
So I had actually, my legs were straight, but it was perfectly comfortable. But we were on the plane I timed it because there was literally nothing else to do than think about boring math stuff like that. We were on the plane for 13 and a half hours. It's quite a long time to be on a plane. I didn't go to sleep, not 1 minute.
No.
But yeah, got back, saw the beasts, and they had these massive banners made up for me, you know, welcome home, daddy, just 15 pieces of A4 sellotape together. And they used white paper and like yellow pens, so you basically can't read it. I was like, they're running towards me. I was like, let me stop you there. That is ridiculous. You've been impractical. You haven't thought about this. But as soon as I came in, they dropped them anyway on the floor and pegged it over. And brilliant.
Were there tears?
Yeah, one of them cried. One of them's a machine.
No, from you?
There weren't, actually. I thought there would be because I'm a bit of a crier, like you. Have you ever cried? Did you cry when you were a baby?
I'm like the Terminator 2, mate. Like, I feel I should. I now know what it feels to cry, but nothing comes out. I don't know. Maybe it's my tear ducts.
Yeah, maybe. So, yeah, really nice. I'm at home now, obviously, and the kids are here. It's a school day, but I got in contact with the school and said, look, been away a while. Mind if I keep them home? We're going to Claire's Accessories and then swimming after this.
Perfect.
Real life.
Now, you've been getting some stick on social media, Flats. You've sort of become the Katie Hopkins of rugby. You've taken over from Andy Good, that's for sure, for a couple of things. But in fairness, there's quite a lot of support for you as well. And, you know, hopefully you'll name drop a couple of the guys and I will go and sort them out.
It's not about me.
No, of course not. We'll get to the major bone of contention in a bit. But just a few people wanted to pick up on something you raised with Eddie Jones in your after-match interview.
Eddie, firstly, commiserations. What do you think went wrong tonight?
Look, we just struggled to get on the front foot. They were very aggressive around the ruck in the breakdown, and obviously they had dominance in the scrum, and it wasn't until late in the second half we got any parity in the scrum, and it's hard playing off back foot ball.
Did you feel like England weren't able to get their game plan going, or South Africa just kind of beat it out of them?
Well, I think it's a bit of both. South Africa were the winners of the World Cup. We weren't quite good enough today, but I can't fault the effort of my players. They've been outstanding throughout the World Cup and played with a lot of pride and passion.
You asked Eddie to be judged solely on the result of this World Cup. Do you personally see this result as a success or a failure?
Well, I don't think that's relevant at this stage. I'm just thinking about my team. They're hurting badly enough.
And we hear things on the touchline, like the bus is 25, 20 minutes late. Do you think that disrupted the team and caused them to start a bit slowly and perhaps be a bit less accurate in the first 10 minutes?
Oh, we don't have any excuses, mate.
Now, someone said England never got off the bus.
They did, they were playing.
Yeah, they were. It was half an hour late.
Less, that's growing all the time.
Is it?
Post-match, I said, listening to that, 25, 20 minutes, and I realised that the more we talked about it, the longer it got.
What actually happened?
They were 20 minutes late. They were not 25 minutes late from what I know.
Do you know why they were late?
I think traffic.
Well, they weren't expecting traffic, were they, on World Cup final day?
They were. So it's quite interesting. So do you want me to tell you about it or not?
I was going to back you up, mate, because I was going to go along the lines of, like, everything is so short and sharp during match days. You get to the stadium, you have a little bit of time just to sit and just reflect, get your kit on, but then it's bang, 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 all the way up to kick off. So 20 minutes can have quite a big effect on you because you've got to get strapping done. You know, you don't want to be rushing around too much. You want to take your time a little bit, but then once you go onto the field, it is drill after drill after drill back in. You don't really have time to think. So I think 20 minutes can put you off a little bit. I mean, it's not ideal. It would have a little bit of an effect, I'm sure, for your mental preparation. All right? Well, you weren't expecting that, were you?
I wasn't, actually. I'll tell you the background to it. I mean, the truth is I'm not convinced it had any impact at all. I'm with a producer on site, right? So the producer's there and it's like, right, the late bus thing is a thing. This is a thing. So-and-so in the studio, I don't know if it was Clive or Lawrence or someone has said, that is a problem. You arrive 20 minutes late because England arrived quite late anyway. They arrive an hour and 15 before the game.
Yeah.
Or an hour and 20 before the game. That is not early. That's not a huge amount of time. So when you're getting off the bus 55 minutes before kickoff and walking through the crowd, less than an hour till you play, for me, I would have felt that is not enough time, but you deal with it.
Stress levels rise a little bit.
Yeah, and I do think once the game starts, you get over it.
Yeah, of course, you forget about it.
The point was, let me back up. I'm interviewing Eddie Jones, pitch side, waiting for Eddie Jones to get there. I'm like, God, he's been a while. So Gareth comes out, the media guy, and I say, where are they at, mate? Are they not here yet? I said, oh, I thought you were on the same bus. No, we come separately. I come ahead to sort the press stuff out. They're a bit late. And I was like, oh, well, they're really late. God, it's 6 o'clock kickoff. I was like, God, it's 5 o'clock. They're not here yet. Or 5 to 5, they're not here yet. And he's like, oh, I'll be fine. And then interviewed Eddie, didn't say anything else about it. Went up to the media room to get a coffee and saw Gail Davis from Sky Sports. And I mentioned it to her. And I said, a bit of a rush getting the old coffees on because they were late. And she said, yeah, well, apparently they hit traffic, but they practiced it. Apparently they practiced it in Dublin when they beat Ireland in the Six Nations in early this year. They deliberately, Eddie Jones foresaw, he said, right, there will be a lot of traffic. Traffic is bad in Tokyo and the surrounding areas like Yokohama. So we're going to practice being late. We're going to get to the ground 20 minutes later than normal and see how the boys handle it. They smashed Ireland, obviously. So I think it wasn't intentional. I think they just hit traffic, but everyone thought it'd be okay. And I reckon that ain't why they lost the game. However, the background is, the sort of editorial bit behind it is, as a reporter, which is my job at this World Cup, as you well know, you have to ask the right questions. And now and again, you will miss a question. There might be something you miss or a mistake you make. Or I might, after one of the games, I think I said Australia scored a couple of lovely tries today and they'd only scored one. And that doesn't really matter too much. That's just human on the spot. But there are some questions you need to ask this question. And if you dodge it, then you are forever the reporter that dodged the question. And everyone who works with you knows. So the producer says to me, right, talking to the studio, they want you to ask Eddie Jones about the bus being late. I said, mate, the bus being late was nothing to do with it. They got hammered up front. We'll talk about that in a minute. Yeah, they want you to ask. I said, no problem.
I'd want you to ask. I want to see his reaction.
Yeah, you're right. I thought there are more important questions to ask. However, if we are the main broadcaster, which we are, our interview is the most seen one in the UK, or it's the main one in the UK, then what if every other news outlet is talking about the bus being late and ITV haven't mentioned it? We've missed it, so I have to mention it. So actually, I wasn't that bothered about mentioning it or not. I said, actually, you can only ever really get three or four questions into Eddie. I think I got four or five, which is, by the end, they're tapping me on the shoulder, time to go.
He was really good, by the way.
And for me, I thought that is the least important of the questions. However, we had to ask it. We asked it. So then what happens is, you get people hammering in on, so they're hammering in. They're not hammering in. They don't know me, so they're not hammering me. But it's like, can't believe you're making excuses and saying that's why England lost the game. Nope, no one said that. Oh, you still think that's why you lost the game? Nope, no one said that. You've made that up. And of course, there are people like the picture of Andy Powell driving the bus that I retweeted this morning. Because like in summer and stuff, and after a big competition, I take a little break from social media because I spend my whole life looking at my phone and it breaks me, to be honest, sometimes. So I thought I'd have a week off, but that picture was so good,
mate,
that I went on, searched that person out and retweeted it because that was genius.
It was amazing.
I love it. But not one person in England thinks that is why England lost the game. But what happens is, it's one of those things that you bring up something that might have been an issue. It's almost like, say we found out before the game, we didn't, that Dan Cole was having back spasms. Then you go to Eddie and say, we've heard Dan Cole had a bad back, but you had no one to replace him. By the way, this is not true, making it up. And then you say to Eddie, is it right that Dan Cole had a bad back? What you then get is about 100 million people or 100 people on Twitter who aren't English, who basically are glad England have lost, which is just the way it goes. And they're saying, you're making excuses. No, we're not. We're asking a completely legitimate question. So if Wales lost a really tight semi, which they did, if we found out that Dan Biggar actually had a bad knee, the very first or the second question I would ask Warren Gatland is, was Dan Biggar's knee all right? Because we've heard this. That is the job. So that was it. It's not, the bus has got nothing to do with it in my mind, but it's not ideal, is it, if you're preparing for a test match?
And only people who have been in that situation would know, because you don't have much time. That would have caused stress levels. There's no doubt about that. And it's not the reason why they lost, but it would have caused stress levels before the game. But I think what really got your Twitter followers going, and I loved it, was you sad? What were you sad about?
I wasn't sad. No, I wasn't sad.
you've taken on circa 3 million people in Wales on your own.
No, I haven't. I've taken on about 200 of them. The rest of them are nice. The best bit is, which is like, you're anti-Welsh. I'm half Welsh, mate.
It's just friendly rivalry. So you're going to have to expect a bit of a backlash. I loved it, by the way. Like, it properly entertained me for about an hour.
I know you did. I loved your tweet. Who's had a go at you, fella? I'll bloody smash him. I love that. Oh, I was laughing hard at that. It's like that Andy Powell bus thing I had to tweet. It's because I'm lying in bed, awake with jet lag or whatever. And we were texting each other, whatever. And you sent me that picture and I just kept giggling to myself. I was like, that is just absolutely class. And it's the whole, I just imagine Powley driving the bus in.
Yeah.
I was just laughing and laughing. So before the game, you know, we are literally paid for our opinions. Now, there are people who are paid to give their opinions who dodge giving them as much as they possibly can in case they're wrong.
In your opinion that you paid for, who's that?
No chance. No chance. Like, predictions don't work. Predictions are a terrible idea. But basically, it's like you have so many people tweeting you saying, what do you reckon? It's like, well, absolutely what I reckon. You know, England were in the semi-finals. England were by about 50,000 miles the best team in the semi-finals. They obliterated a New Zealand team that obliterated Ireland in the first half. They were just unbelievable. South Africa were involved in one of the worst semi-finals I've ever seen. I commentated on it, so I know the game reasonably well. It was awful. What there is going to worry England? And I'm thinking, not a lot, because the scrum wasn't monstrous. It was good, but it wasn't monstrous.
Yep.
So what is it that's going to kill England? And I was like, I just don't see it. So what you do is, I put a tweet out there anyway, and I said, look, the way I said, I just don't see a way South Africa beat England, right? Just like every other pundit who called it that way. Like,
I had England by 9, I think.
There you go. Well done. I had England by 8, so I had England by less than you, actually.
What are you meant to go on, apart from form, in a short competition?
Right, exactly. So then what happens is, about 10 minutes in the end, when it was clear England weren't going to win, I picked up my phone and I just quote tweeted my own prediction tweet. And I said, you know, at 70 minutes in or whatever it was, this is a tweet that doesn't appear to have aged well. Something like that, as a joke, obviously.
Love it.
And Paul O'Connell was sitting next to me. He's like, did you just tweet something? I said, yeah. Why did you tweet now? And I was like, I just tweeted this. And he was laughing. He's like, never give prediction. Never, ever. I was like, mate, it's all right for you. You're not on, you don't do the social media ting. It doesn't work. You know? So what a great bloke. Anyway, so that comes out. And then you have loads of people who just don't bother reading that. And we all tweet stuff about the final. And I was like, South Africa, just amazing. Brilliant.
Yeah.
Congrats, all that stuff, just brilliant. England blown away. Yeah, they were just brilliant. But what people like to do, lots of people, it's a very small minority of fans, they like to find the tweet.
It is, David, it is.
Where you said this, and loads of them say, this aged well, this aged well, this aged well. Yeah, I know, I just said that. This aged well. Yeah, I know, I just said that. But then there are, specifically in this case, the Welsh, and I've said it on our podcast before. By the way, as you know, there probably isn't a English pundit, whatever, commentator, who is more keen for the Welsh to do well than me, right? Because because through you, I know some of the boys reasonably well. They're great boys.
My people love you, mate. My people love you.
And I'm actually half Welsh. My mum was born in Wales, so I'm more Welsh than Alwyn Jones. Basically, I'm basically grew up in Bonner Mine.
It's only the ones that look at you in your tweed driving your Range Rover that don't actually know you. You just mentioned Bonner Mine there quickly. I sent you the video of Bonner Mine Rugby Club, which is Alwyn Jones's first rugby club. And there's a video on social media. It's brilliant. They are all in South Africa tops. Every single person there. The rivalry is still huge between Wales v England. There's no doubt about that.
Well, it is for the Welsh. It's bigger for the. I honestly think it's bigger for the Welsh. I think it's not so big for England.
I think it's bigger for the Welsh than it is for the Scottish and the Irish as well. I just think it means a lot more to the Welsh through history.
Yeah, well, I'm sure there are lots of reasons why. But the thing I find sad is, and it's more pathetic than it is sad. It was more sad pathetic. And I'd bet my last tenner, there are as many English people doing it as there are Welsh and Irish and Scottish. It just so happened that Welsh were the people on the day, right? Every country has got people doing it. South Africans will have people doing it. Kiwis doing it, the lot. England losing the final. And in the end, it was like, it was just this absolute torrent of abuse. And it's not necessarily towards me, but it's just like, why do people do that? English fans will do it as well. Why do people do that stuff? And everyone's like, that's sport. No, it's not. It's not sport.
Well, if you want the answer to that, you've got to go really deep, mate. And I'm not prepared to go really deep.
You can't. You haven't got it in you.
No, you're right. I haven't. But anyway, you recover from it. Well done. there was a lot of support out there, more so than the trolls. And plenty of people, mostly my family, have said, what a great job you did. So
my mum and dad think I did really well. They haven't seen it yet, but they think I did really well.
You hold your head high, fella. Just know deep down the rivalry is there, and I will personally drive you around. We'll do a tour of Wales, if you like, in the Pokemobile, just to get you back in as one of their favourite pundits.
The other thing is, like, this is a bit more controversial, but I'll try and word it properly. But I think the truth is, you're a retired pro, we're all retired pros, right? So we've done it at varying levels at the top level for varying amounts of time at the top level. So me for a very short amount of time, you for a long time. You want Wales to win. I want England to win. That is about where it ends. England lose the World Cup. I'm gutted for the blokes I know in the team. I'm gutted for Steve Borthwick, probably more than anyone else. I'm disappointed, not gutted, disappointed for them. I honestly don't lose sleep over a team I used to play for losing games. I just don't. One of the best things about retiring from sport is that that pressure is gone. The anxiety, the fact that it ruins your week is gone. And if people think it's just me, you're miles off, absolutely miles off. It is all, not all, we almost every ex-pro really wants their old team to win. But if they don't, they get on with their job and they go out for dinner just like anyone else. We are not crying into our beer on a Saturday night because we've left that behind. We're more objective now and the stress just isn't there.
I mean, in conclusion, don't poke the beast, all right?
No, you've bottled that.
Don't poke the beast.
No, you're bottling it. You asked me who's bottling it. You're bottling it.
Well, you haven't asked me a question. Just been listening to you talk. Anyway, we'll put this to bed now. Let's get on to the final game.
Paxman.
How come, now that you are the best person to ask this, how come the scrum was just so dominant for South Africa? Because we didn't see it as dominant against Wales. Did they just up their game because it was a World Cup final? Were they more switched on because it took England apart?
It's the ref's fault.
Really?
And the bus was late.
Did Jerome Grasser's ref it correctly?
Do you know, I've heard a lot of people saying they were unhappy with Jerome Grasser's refing of the scrum.
Okay.
I wasn't.
Okay.
It's never perfect. A couple of times I thought he's going to guess here. And I sit with Paul O'Connell and he's like, ah! I was like, what? And Paul's like, he's going to guess. And he didn't guess. He reset or he let him play on. And I actually thought he did quite well. And there will be the odd case for this angle wasn't right or the beast was coming in, boring in a little bit. Or there always is. If you are a scrum that is moving forward, there was chat when Dan Cole popped up.
Remember that one?
Malcolm Marks, I think, popped up as well.
I think Marks popped up first, actually.
He popped up first, but they're moving forward.
Yeah.
So whether you think it's right or wrong, and I've had referees tweeting me things like, this is how it is. And it's like, chill out, mate. You've done a reffing course.
Yeah.
The reality is, Jerome Garcia says the biggest day of his life. And he is very likely to give the decisions to the team, the aggressors and the guys who are moving forward. So England know that. Every player knows that, amateur or pro. Every pro player knows that. If you're moving forward, you're more likely to get the call, unless you're diving through someone's knees. I thought South Africa, they scrummaged on a different level from anything they scrummaged on the tournament. So
yep.
we'll talk team of the week in a minute. And as just a little spoiler, the beast is in mine, but he's only in it for the final. Because he was nothing like that. He's always good. He's always, always high end.
And he only played sort of 40, 50 minutes as well.
He hasn't hit that level for a while. But the main reason, since you're asking, why they were so dominant, it's almost all mindset.
Okay.
So how did they approach it? And they said, they were saying to each other, we are going to kill this English scrum and we are going to work them until they fold. And that's going to win us the game. And if everyone goes in like that, imagine you've got eight against eight, state against state, mate against mate. And you've got a couple of back rowers who want to scrum, but they're thinking 50-50 about getting off, getting job, not missing any tackles. Whereas South Africa are like, right, on our put in. And I remember I said to Clive Woodward on the bus on the way there, it wouldn't surprise me to see them leave that ball in as long as possible. Work, 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 work. The longer it goes on, the more the England back row, England back row really bought in, to be fair, but the more the back row will start thinking, they're going to pick and go, where do I need to be? Whereas the Springboks are just driving, driving, driving. And it is a lot to do with, there's more technical stuff, which I'll mention, but it's a lot to do with mindset.
With Carl Sinclair going off after 2 minutes, you're losing a big hitter, you're losing a big carrier. But am I right in thinking that probably Coles is more of an astute scrummager?
Yep.
Yet he still couldn't solve or fix the problem.
No. I read today, and this is someone else's view, but I sort of think they might be right. I think it might have been Alex Lowe in the Times actually said, Carl Sinclair, there's no positive to him having gone off. There's no positive to that for anyone. But him going off after 2 minutes might have saved him a horrible day, because Dan Cole is England's top scrummaging tight head, rated as England's top scrummaging. So certainly on this tour, there's only two of them.
Maybe, but what you're losing with Sinclair is a big ball carrier as well, and someone that can potentially get you over the gain line and on the front foot.
Absolutely.
And that's what England massively lacked. Not even Tuilagi could get them on the front foot. And you're talking about probably one of the best strike runners in the Northern Hemisphere. Delande and Am and the back row smothered him. In terms of like the South African game plan, look, you know, the first opening 10, 15 minutes, it was a better game than the semi-final already. The endeavour was there. They wanted to try and attack. But what they do love is just putting the ball up in the air, because if it's a kick to challenge, not often are you going to take that cleanly if the kick is spot on. So players are going to jump up. You know, it's either going to be knocked on, it's either going to be advantage to play, or they're going to call it back for a scrum, which is exactly what South Africa wanted. But defensively, I've not seen a performance like that really for a long time of a team dominating collisions, dominating the whole game with their defence. Delande, now he's not a massive bloke when you look at his stats of his weight, but he plays like he's 18 stone. He was a bear defensively, smothered everything up. And even like South Africa's blindside defence, you know, they were all geared up for the switch plays that England used with Ben Youngs throwing the ball over the top. You know, there was just no options for England whatsoever. And I think, Flats, that if you're going to start the game like we thought they would with Ford and Farrell, two ball players, you've got to play ball, haven't you? There's no point in having two players like that if you're not really going to attack. And I think England a little bit went into their shells a little bit. You know, they started panicking and trying to run the ball out from their own 5 meter line. They weren't exiting the field very well. Positional and territory kicking, didn't see really any of that. And you've got a 10 and a 12 who are brilliant at that. You've also got 15, Elliot Daly, who's a great kicker as well. And we didn't see any of that whatsoever. So you're sort of thinking, why play two ball players if you're not going to play? And I know South Africa stopped them. Pippi and Chesin Kobe were immense on their wings defensively, snuffing out every single attack. But how do you play against that defence? It is so difficult.
It's so difficult. And that is why front row forwards or big props, high-end props, get paid so much money. And it's not a myth. It's just not a myth. It's again, Sir Clive said to me after the game, and he said, that's why you and your prop mates, you know, the most valuable players on the field. And I said, well, not me, mate. You never picked me. Trevor Woodman, yeah. You know, if you think, like, I was talking about it on Saturday night, and if you got Wayne Gretzky, one of the greatest ice hockey players ever, whatever, there's that brilliant documentary on Netflix, I think it's called Goon, and he talks about this hard man who basically came with him throughout his career, and his enforcer, his protector. And he said, without him, no one knows who I am. I need him. He needs me, and I need him.
Yeah.
You know, without Carl Heyman and Owen Franks, Dan Carter ain't the player he was. I mean, he's still a great player, but he's not the same. George Ford and Owen Farrell needed England's front five to at least gain parity. And I mean, I did a thing before the game, and it was, if England can achieve parity in the scrum and not get shoved backwards and concede penalties, they will be in an infinitely better position. The idea of them trying to monster the South African scrum wasn't going to happen. And even pre-match, those of us that have played sort of in the front row, in the front five, saying all they need is parity, because France Malherber on the tight head, he's kind of a modern day Julian White. He's decent enough around the field. He does a job, doesn't carry much. He's good at hitting rucks. He makes his tackles, but he is there for one reason and one reason only. So if you've got effectively a one trick pony at test level, he better be very good at that trick. And he is. So but for me, if your pack is going backwards, it is so difficult to win a match. And then if you say, right, let's go route one, you don't want to go route one into Etzebeth, Diaga, Dutoy, Vermeulen. You don't want to go there because they are so strong and abrasive. And by the way, just before we move off the scrum, because the scrum was the main thing for me, because it's they're conceding penalties at set piece in their own half, and that's the game dead. So that's what kills you if the opposition can kick their goals. But Dan Cole has just been pasted in the press the last 2 days, and he did. There's no disguising it. Everyone's been there. Everyone's had a horrible horror day. His was on the biggest day of his life, which is just brutal. But credit to the beast, he was mega. But it's not all Dan Cole. It's not all Dan Cole. Mako Vunipola is on his day, like in the semi-final, the world's best ball-playing prop, I think. And all round, he's against the All Blacks. He looked wonderful because Laulalo on the tight head is not yet a top-of-the-range test scrummager. He's fine. He's good, but he's not damaging. He's not a killer yet. So Mako can effectively survive that for 50, 60 minutes and hang on and do a decent job in the scrum. But then you come up against a specialist. What happens is Malherber gets stuck into Mako Vunipola, and effectively when the loose head, if you imagine the loose head is called a loose head because he's kind of on the outside, once he started losing that battle, it is very, very hard to regain, because you're almost not attached to the tight head anymore. So you swing your hits up and out and try and attack him from the side a little bit. Doesn't work, because you come away from your hooker, you come away from your second row. If you imagine the loose head's hips and the hooker's hips splitting apart, it weakens your scrum instantly. So then all that weight that Mako had on his inside shoulder of Mal Herbert is kind of no longer really on Mako. It's moving on to Jamie George, and it's moving on to Dan Cole. So Dan Cole had the beast to deal with. He had Mbonambi, who's just class, and he's mega strong. He's an absolute unit. And then Malcolm Marks to deal with. He also had a good portion of France Malherbe's weight coming across. So there are days when you just do battle. And I would say he battled. Coley had a horrible day. There's no question. But it's not all to do with the tight head in situation like that. It's actually indirectly the South Africa tight head is doing damage to the English loose head, to the English tight head, sorry. But I just thought they were so aggressive, man.
What a stat it is. Mpipi to score the first ever try for South Africa in a final.
I know. Amazing.
That was a great... He played really well. He was good in the air. The chip ahead, and also for Lucanio Am, the blind pass.
Oh, so good.
Didn't even need to do it. He probably could have gone himself, but it was amazing. And then Chesin Colby, I think it was turned over, lost in the tackle by Henry Slade, I believe.
Yeah, it was, yeah.
If you pause it when Chesin Colby gets that try, you've got three England players, right, hunting him down. Joe Marler's one, Farrell's another. I can't remember who the third is, but he stops a little bit. And that sort of checks Joe Marler. Then he goes. And because Joe Marler's checked, by the time he steps inside, which is unbelievable power for a small guy to step inside and run through Owen Farrell's arm, which is his strongest tackle, and finish it off, that is a moment of brilliance from a class player.
Do you know who I thought of when he scored that? Shane Williams.
Yep. But Chesin Colby didn't really have much to do the whole game. But when he got his chance... gone. See you later. Like, defended really well, but wasn't much ball for him. But it was just it was a class try from an unbelievable player.
But what I like about him is, if you just watched his highlights reel, he's your classic. If you just watch him for 10 minutes on YouTube, 5 minutes on YouTube, he's really small. He's a tiny little bloke. I mean, he's absolutely tiny little bloke. He's no bigger in real life, let me tell you. He is your classic one-trick pony. Only you actually watch him play in a game properly, he's nothing of the sort. He happens to be tiny and just dazzling on his feet. He's also, I mean, brave in defence. He's not just brave, he's properly physical in defence.
Yeah.
And like Faf de Klerk is tiny. And, mate, they hit so hard, those little fellas.
Like Terrius, Willy LaRue, I thought, under the high ball, where we thought South Africa might be a little bit of a weakness for him at 15. You know, you've put that ball up. We've seen Willy LaRue drop quite a few for Wasps and for South Africa. Solid. Brilliant in the air. Don't think he dropped one at all. He commanded that space. Massive occasion, and he had a huge game as well. Because if you look at a weakness there, I would have said that under the high ball, the South African back three.
Because someone said to me that he'd been getting an absolute hammering in the South African press because his form's been so bad. And
yep.
He hasn't been in good form. He just hasn't. And he just produced it on the day. And fair dues. I mean, that's a top player, that. He's not in great form, but manages to pull it out. And in contrast... I know he must be nearly 40 caps in by now. I love watching Elliot Daly play rugby. I'm not sure I've ever quite loved watching him play fullback. I don't know what you think. I know he runs brilliantly. He's got lovely hands, lovely footwork.
Couple of mistakes. Ball on the floor, head up, knocks it on. Everything just didn't go England's way. You look at Anthony Watson running down the right, goes to the ground, ball just gets dislodged from his hand. Ref or touch judge picks it up, knock on. Lost momentum completely. Back row were fantastic for South Africa as well. Steph de Toit, who you picked out in the semi-final against Wales, had another phenomenal game. Wins player of the tournament.
Player of the year. World player of the year. What a player. Oh.
I know. Just before we put this game to bed, my thoughts on their medal presentation. Now, nearly every England player takes their medal off straight away. Mario Toji won it and accept it. You know, you're humbling when you win, you should be humbling defeat. I've never seen a Olympian at a medal ceremony not accept their silver medal, unless it's maybe for political reasons, I don't know. You know, you clap players off, and that's what you do. I thought it was bad sportsmanship. Now, I know they want to win. I know it was disappointment because they lost and they wanted to win. There was no doubt about that. But put the medal on, even if it's for 2 or 3 minutes. I think it disrespects the South Africans and the game that they've played. Would we have seen any other team? Japan.
That is actually a great point. I hadn't thought of it like that.
It was only Curry I saw with his medal on. Now, it's not a big thing to us. The huge disappointment. We see it in football. You see that in football when teams finish second. You know, they take their medals off straight away. And, you know, the football claim that it's a sport built on respect. It isn't. Rugby is a game built on respect. And I just feel that there was a little bit of disrespect shown by the England players there. Yes, be disappointed. Wear the medal for 5 minutes. That's all you're asking. I'm not sure what you make of it.
At the time I saw them doing it, didn't cross my mind to be offended by it. Not to be offended, that's the wrong... You're not offended, you just think it was poor form.
I was just a little bit disappointed that they didn't front up and wear their silver... You know, they were beaten by a better team on the day. They have no complaints. Wear the medal, take it off when you get in the changing room.
Yeah, I think you've got a point. I think you've got a point. Were I in that situation, could I see myself not wearing that? And I absolutely could see myself not doing it. And I don't think I think I'm any better than I am or better player than I was. I just think... Yeah, I think you're right. I actually think you're right. Yeah, it's not great. But then after, say, New Zealand game, TJ Perenara comes in and does these beautifully humble, lovely, really complimentary, balanced interviews straight after the game, after they've been knocked out, you know, when they were sort of due to win it, in a sense, in many people's eyes. And never had so many England players say they're willing to be interviewed after the final.
Yeah.
No, never seen so many interviews done. They just kept coming, mate. Really gracious.
Yeah, they were very gracious in defeat, but I just felt they let themselves down a little bit with that medal ceremony. But it just shows you what it means to them.
Yeah.
But you do it to be the bigger person, really, and to be humble. But, I mean, I think England were probably the best team of this tournament. You look at the quality that they play throughout there. They can be disappointed, but I think they can still hold their heads high, mate. They play some brilliant rugby. They lost to a better team on the day. But reaching a final has to be a huge positive.
Yeah.
They didn't win it, and you feel sorry for them because they lost in 2007 in the final as well. But what they achieved with a group of players that will probably all go on to the World Cup in 4 years' time, I think it's a great achievement from them.
If you look at who won't make the next World Cup, you'd say Ben Youngs, Dan Cole, probably Courtney Laws, got 80 caps, I think, now, and he's not young anymore. That is kind of it. I mean, there are a lot of lads there that will still be flying in 4 years, all being well. And doesn't mean they'll all get picked. I mean, you know, you've got other things to do with your life. But I've been keeping up with the Premiership. And you look at Ben Earl, you look at Ted Hill, you look at some of the young lads playing at Northampton. You're like, Christ, you know, these boys ain't just going to walk to the next World Cup. There's some competition about. But that's why I think, although my job after the game was to ask Eddie, lots of these players will go again. Will you go again? Kind of thing. And all the journalists have to ask that. I think he might want to leave. I don't think he does. But I think it would be a really, really big decision to sack Eddie Jones. I don't think they will. Clive Woodward lost in 99, won in 03. Think about it. Took that team forward. And think about what Eddie Jones has learned. All that intellectual property, all that IP is so valuable. That's why I think football clubs get it so wrong. Everyone talks about how much you learn from losing. It's so important. And then you lose a few and you get sacked. It's like, well, in football, I don't think the model works.
It's a tough ask to beat Australia, All Blacks and South Africa, one after the other. So they've done well, England. I think they've done really well to reach a final. It wasn't to be. Beaten by a better team, no complaints. And a great performance in the World Cup.
Well, if the bus weren't late, they'd have won it. That's the worst bit, isn't it?
We like to know what's what in the world, don't we, Tommy?
Yeah, we do. The Economist is far more than just economics and finance, David. It covers a range of subjects from world politics and business to science, technology, arts, the environment, and of course, sport.
Yeah, and I was on the internet recently. There was an article about how little's being done to protect sportsmen and women from brain injuries, which is pretty topical at this stage. Some of the hits we've seen in this World Cup, holy majoli. And there was another one on how Japan's learned to love rugby, and they really, really have. From what we've witnessed, they really, really adopted it. They love it.
And what's great about The Economist, it sifts through all the noise. It focuses on the essential information. It tells the real story.
Yeah, and it's been going for over 170 years. Did you know that?
No.
Now you know.
It's for the kind of person who never stops asking questions, Dave, and wants to know why the world is that way. Why?
Yeah, and The Economist is the smart guide to the forces changing your world. So if you've never stopped asking questions, you can get a free copy now. For your free print copy of The Economist, just text ITV to 78070.
That is ITV to 78070.
I'm Sam Warburton, and you're listening to the ITV Rugby World Cup podcast.
Now, there's every chance you'll have seen this interview already, people, but we wanted to play it for you anyway, because it's really darn good. Argyle Douglas, a.k.a. Jim Douglas, has upstaged a private gag. I'll tell you what that is. So basically, in the last World Cup down in Gloucester, Jill, Ugo and I ordered a Chinese food delivery to Teague's Bar in Gloucester after a game. We had a couple of pints. We had a Chinese and it came in and they delivered it. And on the bags, it said Jim, Hugo and Flaps with a P. So she's been Jim ever since. Anyway, she's upstaged us on the pod many times so far through this World Cup. Tommy, God bless her. She makes us look like amateurs, but that's the way it goes sometimes. But she may very well have saved her best until last with this effort in the company of Brian Habana and the Springbok captain, Sia Khaleesi.
When you were a young boy, just beginning to start out on your journey with rugby and all the challenges you faced, I mean, in your wildest dreams, did you think about a day like today?
I never dreamt of a moment like this at all. Brian would tell you, when I was a kid, all I was thinking about is getting my next meal. And, you know, and I just, there's a lot of us out there in South Africa. All we need is an opportunity. And I got my opportunity and I took it with both hands. And yeah, there's so many stories like this that hasn't been told in South Africa.
And what do you think this might mean for the country now? Because it's been such a significant moment. I think you've seen the reaction of everybody here and all over the world.
I'm hoping that we've just given people a little bit of hope to pull together and work together as a country and make our country better.
Comrade, you let your dad fly out of South Africa for the first time ever. A moment as momentous and as incredible as this. Your thoughts of having your dad in a stadium celebrating something that will go down in the history of South Africa as one of the best ever.
Thank you so much, Comrade. Yeah. You can never forget where you come from, and you can never forget the people that have been there for you. So that's what I wanted to do, you know, and just celebrate it with him, something he would never been able to do for me, and I wanted to do it for him. And hoping my brother and sisters just take a little bit of that. You know, I wish I had them here. But yeah, I can't wait to get back home and celebrate.
Really, for those people that don't know, so Sia found his half brother and half sister a couple of years ago, and he's actually adopted them. So he's not only looking after little beautiful Kezi and little Nick, but this man's heart, his generosity, it transcends the four lines of what we experience in South Africa. I got a bit emotional in a Q&A this week, and I sent that video to Sia, knowing the hope he's created, the inspiration he is to people like myself. We have seen his journey but know so much more. And my friend, I know Tata Madiba's up there in heaven smiling down on you. We're incredibly proud.
Thank you so much.
See, before I let you go, just give us an idea of what you expect when you get back to South Africa. How do you think that reception will be?
I asked John how is it at home, John de Villiers, and he said it's 10 times than what I've seen before. So, and he told me there'll be much more, so I really don't know what to expect.
And for those of you that don't know, Sia's running for president of South Africa next year.
I'm going to let you go. Congratulations. Thank you so much.
Done a million views, that boy, on Twitter.
Incredible. I love the fact Khaleesi swapped his shirt with Curry as well. You know, it's a World Cup final. You'd probably want to keep that shirt. Maybe he's got two. Maybe he changed it at halftime.
He's got a spare. It's 2019.
But what a gesture as well.
So cool for Curry, actually.
Yeah, that's what, you know, what a gesture from Khaleesi to Curry, because I guarantee if that was me and I won a World Cup final, I would not be swapping shirts. They'd be kept for special occasions.
But he's a better bloke than you, and you can see that instantly.
Yeah, maybe he is. I'm not perfect.
His story is amazing, isn't it? Khaleesi's story is amazing.
Yeah, it is. You know, he was born into one of the ghettos at 16 years old, wasn't he? His mother died at 15. You know, he had to really fight his way into that team, worrying about his next meal. And people like Brian Habana put it into context. You know, everything was there for Habana. You know, he went to good schools. He had the best education, the best sports. So I love seeing those two as well, embracing on the field after the match. Did you see it? Proper respect,
yeah, lovely,
there between Habana and Khaleesi. And a lovely moment as well. What he's doing as well, a captain for the team, for inspiring youngsters through, giving them something to work for, because a lot of them don't. A lot of them don't have any role models. And to see a black captain, and it was just perfect, wasn't it? Wearing the number six, you're the president of South Africa wearing the number six, talking about 1995 World Cup. Everything was set, wasn't it? When you look back now at the game, everything was set for South Africa to win.
Yeah, it was mega. It was just mega. And leading into the World Cup, I think you and I were doing a bit of corporate, but we were at a dinner somewhere and someone said, who's just going to win the World Cup? And I said, well, you've got to make New Zealand favourites. But I just, you know, if you had to put money against someone, you wouldn't put any money against South Africa because they're coming good. And then you see them play and you think, nah, they can't win it like that. And the semi-final, they can't win it like that. And you realise now it was written in the stars if you're into that sort of stuff. I'm not, you're not, but some of the listeners might be.
When you listen to Razi Erasmus and Kaliso speaking after the match, they're not speaking about rugby. They're speaking about their journeys. Yeah, they're speaking about the country. Yeah, looking back now, mate, I'm really glad South Africa won and what it's meant to the players and what it's meant to the country. I'm sorry to say that to you.
Yeah, but even when you're English and you want England to win, we're all still able to appreciate that. Like, the team that beat New Zealand the week before, to bash them like they bashed them and have the game won, it felt so early for a World Cup final. To have it won that early, to be that dominant, I thought he was just absolutely outstanding and they deserved it.
Wales, New Zealand, third, fourth playoff. We know that was a massive game on the Friday. I watched it with Bubs naked on the sofa.
I enjoyed that.
Yeah, it was good. It was good. There's people saying, oh, why couldn't Wales play that against South Africa? Because South Africa stopped you.
They couldn't. Why didn't England play like that? Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. But that was going to be a tough ask, wasn't it? Wales to beat New Zealand after 66 years, I think it is, with a lot of injuries. Liam Williams out, George North out, Lee Halfpenny out. Halim Amos started at 15, finally got a try after denied three against Uruguay. A lovely ball it was by Patchell. Wales looked really good attacking with Rhys Patchell at 10.
I love him at 10, boy, but I've said that before, haven't I, on here?
He's all out attack, though. I think if you can find that balance between, say, the territory kicking game of Dan Biggar, the positional play of Dan Biggar with the boot and Rhys Patchell's attack, then you've got a great 10 there.
I think I was with Nick Easter and James Haskell at a dinner a few years ago. And someone said, thing is, boys, what you really want is Haskell's body with Nick Easter's talent and brain.
Yeah.
It was like, you've managed to offend them both there.
I think if you could combine Dan Biggar and Rhys Patchell, you've got the ultimate 10. I really think that. Josh Adams scores a try, seventh.
How good was Josh Adams in this World Cup?
Oh, mate, he's Wales' best player. And thanks for backing me up on that as well. Yeah, he's been Wales' best player through this World Cup. Hungry. His work rate is as good as any player in the world. Wants to get his hands on the ball. Good footwork. Gets over the gain line, you know, in traffic congested areas as well. Finishes off tries.
He's a Welsh Jack Noel, isn't he?
Learned his trade in Worcester as well. Just think, you know, everything happens for a reason. You know, it certainly has with Josh Adams. Leaves Scarlets, you know, learns his trade at Worcester. Now on a big deal back at the Blues. He's been Wales' best find in the last 18 months. There's no doubt about that. But you're coming up against players like Ryan Crotty, Ben Smith. Haven't played for a long time.
Oh, my God, Ben Smith.
I know. I know.
Joke. I mean, joke good, wasn't he? Unplayable. He looked stronger than everyone else. He just looked faster and stronger than everyone else, like it wasn't fair.
And he's a player that he doesn't physically tower over other players, does he? He's just a ball player. You know, you look at him, he's obviously got muscles, but he's not dominating people in contact area. He just uses skill, footwork, and reads the game better than...
Oh, one thing on a bit of a tangent, something you said earlier that I forgot, for once I didn't butt in. Damian Diolande looks like a reasonably big, strong bloke. Stats make him not huge. So I stood next to him after the game the other day. He is way bigger than you think.
Really?
A lot of these guys are. He is way bigger. He is an absolute unit. He could play in the South African back row. I'm serious when I say that. He is a proper unit.
The last three games he played against Japan, against Wales and England, mate.
Yeah, it wasn't fair, was it?
Anyway, if you want to watch the highlights of the game or check out Flats and Shanks in Japan, all you got to do is head to the ITV hub before it's too late because they will be off soon. The episodes are BAFTA winning, Golden Globe winning. They are incredible. There's a massive budget behind it. And we do some incredible things in Japan.
It's like The Office, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, and you won't realise how good they are till they're gone. So
it's like Arrested Development. I mean, it's serious.
Fly into them.
It's like the first couple of series of Dexter.
As the tournament is now done and finished, we thought we'd take time to reflect upon the home nations. And we'll briefly go through these because we realise this is a long podcast today, but we've got a lot to talk about. Scotland. We'll start with Scotland. Disappointing. Disappointing.
Mega disappointing, yeah.
With the players they've got, the quality they've got, I don't think it's a case of get rid of Gregor Townsend. I think you've got to stick with him. And we said this on previous pods. You know, Scotland have gone all out to keep him. They've let go of Vern Cotter. Gregor Townsend is the man. You've got to stick by him. I just think what Scotland miss is a big player. They've got big players like Stuart Hogg and Finn Russell, but talking physically big. So like a Karevi, like a Diolande, like a Tuilagi. Someone in that midfield that can just get them out of trouble. Because at the moment, they don't. They've got a lot of players who are the same size. Powerful, yeah, but I think South Africa have proved that size does matter when it comes to big games.
Well, they need to go shopping then, don't they? They'll probably go shopping before it goes to 5 years from three for qualification.
Let's go shopping in Fiji.
Imagine what... I'm just thinking of names. Like, imagine if they'd... Eliotta, Firmino, Sapulu that play for Samoa, he wouldn't have played for anyone else. He wouldn't do it. But you think, what would Scotland do with a player like that? I mean, he carved up the best teams in the world. We don't need to get onto the whole player nationality thing, but the whole project player thing, going out and finding someone, bringing them in, it's the modern game.
Yeah.
While it is allowed and it's feasible, teams are going to do it if they need to, and Scotland probably need to. Like WP Nell, people don't always agree with it, but he's been worth every penny for Scotland. He's very, very strong indeed.
Ireland, we think, peaked probably 18 months to a year too early. Losing Bundy Aki was a big one for them. I really rate him. Powerful, good ball carrier, good distributor, good passer. Just offers something I think that if you're playing Henshaw at 12, doesn't. And I really like this partnership with Ringrose. So they didn't really hit the heights. Murray and Sexton weren't as effective as we've seen. Some of the Ireland's big ball carries in the pack weren't as good as we've seen previously. So struggle a little bit, Ireland. Andy Farrell's got to do a bit of work there, I think, to get them back. You know, it's going to not do their confidence any good either as well. Not reaching a semi-final again, never reached a semi-final of a World Cup.
Paul O'Connell made a really interesting point to me, fella. I said, everyone's talking about an Irish clear out and you've got to get rid of all these old boys. And he's like, yeah, that's fine, but it's not England. We don't just have three more Peter O'Mahonies. We don't have them. We just don't have a couple of Johnny Sextons up our sleeve. They've actually got some lovely fly-off, but you know, we just don't have loads of them. We haven't got loads of lads.
They got Joey Carberry, and when he came on against...
I love Joey Carberry, yeah.
Yeah, I think he's a really good player as well. But when he came on against Japan, you know, he was missing. He did not command that 10 jersey like a Sexton would do. I think he was quite spooked by it. And what I'm saying is, I agree with you that, and Paul O'Connell, that they don't have the quality of players. They don't have a conveyor belt to pick from. It's a lot like Wales, a lot like Scotland. You know, there's not many teams there.
Like, if you think about an area that, you know, selection that people question with Eddie Jones, the scrum half... Okay, so Willie Hines hurts himself. That's probably sad for him. Ben Spencer gets the nod. But actually, there are four or five lads or more that could have got that call. Five lads, let's say, that could have got that call. Dan Robson could have got the call. Maunder is, you know, okay, he's probably really young, wouldn't have done. Danny Carey, there's loads of guys. Wigglesworth is a top player still. So there are lots of guys that could have got that call who didn't. And Ireland just don't have that. They don't have the numbers. So it's quite, it's a proper job that. He's got a proper job. But they were really, they were underwhelming. Underwhelming, and I think you're right. I think what it came down to is they were spooked. New Zealand were outrageously good against them in the first half, outrageously good, but they were spooked by what Japan brought.
And you think, you talk about starting the tournament big. They did. Ireland started the tournament big against Scotland. It was nearly a complete performance, but yeah, Japan did spook them. Wales, Gat said Wales overachieved in the tournament. Maybe they did. When you look back, maybe they did. With the injuries they've had and not being able to choose from 11 or 12 teams, you know, they'd have four regions to choose from. You lose Anscombe, who was Wales' number 110, leading up to this, losing Faletau. Gats got the best out of that team and they made a semi-final. And I think if you look back at Wales' injury list, especially leading up into the last game, I think they did well. I think they did really well to reach a semi-final.
Do you want my opinion on the whole thing?
Yep.
Same as yours, mate.
Okay.
Same as yours, boy. I'd love to disagree to make the pod better, but I can't. I think, yeah. Who do you reckon's going to win the Six Nations then?
Well, it depends whether you get the old Rugby World Cup hangover or not, which often it does. It depends when the players come back and start playing. If you're looking at form and you're looking at the World Cup, England, they played the best rugby out of, I think, every team in the World Cup.
As long as they don't get stuck in traffic, they could beat anyone.
Exactly. As long as Andy Powell's not driving the bus, they will be fine.
Yeah, exactly.
But look, it's hard to look past them still. None of those teams in the Six Nations will have a defence like South Africa. It's impossible.
But also, the Rugby World Cup hangover thing, I think that is kind of amplified by, or it's exacerbated, whatever the word is, by how much the players have to play between now and then.
Yep.
Now, was talking to Elliot Daly the other day, and he goes, we were joking about it before the final, we were joking about it. And I said something like, you booked 6 weeks in the Bahamas, have you? He said, mate, I think I'm playing next weekend after next because everyone's injured. He signed at a club with loads of fullbacks thinking I'll play 18, 20 games a year and I'll feel great. And I think he might be straight back in. I mean, that just might be the way it goes. This is one of those things that people who aren't English hate English people saying this. But if you are centrally contracted and you can have a set amount of time off, it is golden. It's absolutely golden.
Of course it is.
Yeah, it's up to the club owners now, the club directors of rugby. And I expect the English lads will have a load of rest. But I remember when Sam Warburton was still playing and you and I think were in Cardiff doing a thing with him. And I said, what are you doing? He goes, well, no, I played the last couple of games. So I've got 2 weeks off now. I said, oh, no games. He goes, no, they just pulled me out so I can just do a bit of conditioning and chill. So I'm basically in the gym every day and I'm eating right and just making sure I'm not sore going into the Six Nations. I was like, you know, at that point, what's James Haskell up to? He's doing 80 minutes, 80 minutes, 80 minutes, 80 minutes, 20, 21 tackles a game. And you're like, Christ, that is a completely different preparation. And it's not an excuse, it's just different. But I think the hangover is less likely to affect you if you can have a rest.
Yeah, Wales and Ireland have far more pull over when the players are back and their rest period and how they're integrated back in, because that's the benefits of having smaller amount of teams and being centrally contracted. So, yeah, you know, like Alan Wynn's not going to play for a long time. You know, he's going to have a good rest. Hadley Parks will have a good rest. John Davis, the lot.
I tell you who'll want to play straight as soon as he can is Dan Cole.
Yeah.
He will know it wasn't all. He will know he had a horrible day. He will know it wasn't all his fault. But he's had such a hammering, he'll just want to get back on the horse and get back into the groove and sort of remind himself that he actually does a good job, you know? So it's pretty tough when you're coming off the back of a day like that. But yeah, interesting. Six Nations, who's going to win it? You're saying England. Let's pretend we're both South African. Wouldn't it be great if France won it for the tournament?
Joe, I think it'd be great if Scotland won it. I think they need a bit of positive news.
Yeah, but keep it real, though.
Yeah.
Don't just talk up Scotland in case Hoggy's listening, mate, because he's your mate from golf days. I'd love Scotland to win it. I'm just trying to keep it real. I don't think they're going to win it. I think France could win it if they play...
with 15 men on the field.
If they play better than everyone else, which is the same for any team in the world. And the Six Nations, Tommy, will be upon us before you know it. The opening match between Wales and Italy kicks off on the 1st of February. God, that isn't long, is it?
No.
Alan Wynn ain't playing much rugby between now and then, fella. With plenty of live matches and highlights on ITV. Before we bid you a very fond farewell, we've got one last task, fella, and that is to select our team of the tournament. I'll be doing the forwards, and you, old boy, are going to do the backs. So who are they?
Okay, at 15, I've got Beauden Barrett.
Joke, you're a joke.
No.
You're arrogant. No, you're arrogant, mate.
See the try he scored against Wales on a switch, coming back, getting through like three or four tackles. Mate, his acceleration is brilliant. Radradra at 14. I don't think you can argue with that.
Yeah, but I'm liking these suggestions, really. I'm just trying to be a contrary.
13 was, I found it a little bit tough. I was just thinking, who really, really stood out through the whole of the tournament? Because this is it. This is the team of the tournament. I've gone Tuilagi. John Davis was close, but I just thought,
okay,
Tuilagi really offered a lot. 12, quite difficult. I really wanted to say Karevi, but Delande in the last three games was that one of South Africa's best players. Him and Steph Dutoit just ran the show.
In the big game, Karevi went away against England. In the big games, Diolandi stepped up. That's the difference, isn't it?
I've got Josh Adams on the left wing. 7 tries in the tournament.
Okay.
Record try scorer in the tournament this year. One away from Jonah Lomu, I think Surveyor, and someone else.
He's above Fukuoka. He's above Mapimpi, Colby.
Yes. 10 was another quite difficult decision.
Let me guess, Phil Bennett.
Mwanga. No, I'm not. I'm going to go for Ford.
Are you?
I'm going to go for Ford, yeah. I thought Mwanga was really good against Ireland. Really stood out, and that sort of proved a point of moving Barrett to 15. But I don't know. I like George Ford when he attacks. Through the tournament, I think he's been class. And at 9...
Question for you, fella. Before you do 9, question for you.
Yeah.
What are you going to do when our mate Ben at ITV posts this on Twitter... and it says George Ford at 10, and you've got tweeter after tweeter after tweeter telling you you're a joke because George Ford did this and didn't do this in the final. What are you going to say to them, fella?
George Ford reached the final, and New Zealand didn't reach the final. And if you look at his tournament as a whole, from start to finish, I think he was in my opinion, the number 110. Okay.
And in terms of the other fly half in the final, Pollard does what he does brilliantly, but there are long parts of the game where he has no interest in even taking part. He stands out the way, almost hands on hips. You do it to forwards, 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 bash him, and he just stands there.
If I was picking a special teams player, it'd be Pollard for kicking, for up and unders, for getting back in the pocket, for clearing his lines. But
you're not.
I'm not. And nine. Now, this is another one now that people are probably going to hate.
Oh, you're going to be in trouble.
I think I am. I've gone for Smith at nine. Now, Faf, the clerk, was brilliant. Kicks a lot of ball, though. Loads and loads of ball. But I think if you're looking at a complete nine in everything, in attack, in positional play, and not just kicking, but his whole running of the game, I think Aaron Smith is, for me, number one. I'm sorry, everyone. I'm sorry. But that's my choice.
Tommy, I stand by you. I stand by you. Shoulder to shoulder, I stand by you, okay?
Hit me with your forwards.
I was going for the whole England pack.
Like I did in the semi-final.
That's what you want, isn't it? That's what you want me to say? Okay, number one, I've gone for the beast.
Okay.
Tendai Mutharira, because I actually don't think he had the best tournament, and he doesn't play, he only plays just over half a game because Stephen Kitsoff is so good, and
yeah,
they've got a lovely bench option. But I thought he's in because he was so dominant on the big day. Like, you talk about Vinny LaRue really stepping up, not being in great form, really stepping up for the final. The Beast was in fine form, unremarkable, but obviously he's always very good, but unremarkable. He took himself to a different level on the day when it counted more than any other day.
Yep.
And he was monstrous.
I'm with you on that one. Number two.
Number two, who was very close, first of all? Jamie George, very close, because he just does so little wrong. Even when England lost an early line-out against South Africa in the final, it was a really good throw. It was a perfect throw. I think it was Etzebeth, just defended it really, really well. I sat with Paul O'Connell and he said, Jamie George has done nothing wrong there. It's just a good defence. Mbonambi as well, close for South Africa. Malcolm Marks, a year or two ago, was being called the best hooker in the world. But Mbonambi, I love watching him go. I think he's a class player.
But your two is?
The number two is Horry.
Yep.
Horia, rather, the Japanese hooker. I don't need to say why, do I? He was just class.
He's a bit like Brits, the way he plays, isn't he?
Very, very good. Very, very good. Tight head prop, Carl Sinclair.
Okay.
Best tight head in the competition for me. Mal Herber is a better scrummager. You know, we don't know what Carl Sinclair might have delivered in the final. We just don't know. It'll be very sad what happened to him 2 minutes in. But obviously the right decision getting him off. But I thought he was just magnificent in this tournament. Absolutely magnificent.
The line he hit against Australia was centre-esque.
But also against New Zealand, his link play, his first receiver link play, he is just fantastic. So everyone goes on about Mako, and rightly so, ball in hand. But I think Sinclair is just as good. I think he's absolutely brilliant. So Sinclair, the second row, Lou Diaka,
yes.
Who, yes, he popped his shoulder in the final, but what a player. Sale Sharks have got him. What a player he is. I hope that shoulder comes back full strength, because he's everything. He's got everything. Retallick was amazing on the Friday night in the playoff game, but that's the first. He didn't play much, and there wasn't a huge amount at stake, let's be frank. So it wasn't quite the pressure, but there is a bit at stake. Nothing like a final or a semi-final that game. So he doesn't get it. So Diaka for me, and Maro Itoje.
Yeah, I'm with you.
I know people are going to say Alan Wynne-Jones. I love Alan Wynne-Jones, like everyone does. I think these two are better. That's why I've picked them.
I'm captivated at the moment, mate. I'm in. I'm sucked in. You got me, all right?
Now, I've changed the position. I've put the best player on the whole planet out of position. Is that all right? I'll tell you, I haven't really. I'll tell you why in a minute. I'm playing my flankers not as open side and blind side. I'm playing them left and right.
Okay.
So they both get a crack at each. Peter Steph Dutoy, call him seven if you want, or call him six, whatever you want. Got him at six. I don't need to say why he's in. He's an absolute dominator. And I've got Sam Underhill.
Tipperick. Oh, sorry.
No, Tipperick, very close. I've got written here, Tipperick close.
Okay.
Really close. But you can't, if someone puts, destroys opposition ball runners like Underhill does, I think that is close to irreplaceable in a seven. If you've got, you know, a load of ballers around him, and this is kind of this is your world eight, isn't it? Tipperick, very, very close. But for me, Ardy Surveyor I loved as well, but I thought Tipperick actually had a better tournament than even Ardy Surveyor. But Underhill seven, and Dwayne Vermeulen at eight with Kieran Reid. Kieran Reid close. I thought he really hit form again. I thought he looked great in this World Cup. But Vermeulen is just a beast, mate. He's just a big, aggressive iron man.
I don't understand why teams kick off to him. You're just giving him the ball with 20 meter run up. He ended Thomas Francis, but every single person is the same. Like, you look at where Vermeulen is, you kick to the other side. You have a couple of options because he is phenomenal. I think he's 33? years old. Didn't really, wasn't really featuring in South Africa for the last couple of years. Erasmus brings him back in and he wins the World Cup and wins man of the match in the final game. Mate, the bloke can hit, the bloke can carry better than most eights. Reed's link play, though, is another level. His passing out of contact and his late delivery of balls.
Oh, he was great. He was great. So that's our team. That is our team. And there you have it. The 2019 Rugby World Cup first 15 in our humble little opinions. Even though this is our last show, we'll pop it on Twitter. You won't disagree with my choices, but Shanks has had an absolute nightmare there. We're at ITV Rugby and you can criticise Tom all you like one final time.
Thanks to everyone who's left reviews. Thanks to everyone who's listened. Dave, we've had a blast.
We have, yeah. We'll be back, won't we?
We hope so. We hope so.
Yeah.
The World Cup has taken its toll. I'm now going healthy. I'm now rebuilding myself.
Yeah.
What about you? Have you put much weight on?
It's funny because it was like, right, well, I need to get weighed, yeah. It's like, right, what do you want to eat on your first day back? I was like,
sushi.
Vegetables, vegetables, vegetables.
Yeah.
Then this morning I buckled and I got a bit of steak out the fridge, out the freezer, defrost. But a lot of vegetables is what I need. Mineral water and vegetables for a month.
Yeah.
We've had a hell of a time. I've had a really nice time and we'll see you at the next World Cup / Six Nations in about 15 minutes when it starts.
Hope you've enjoyed the journey.
Yeah, until then, sayonara and arigato gozaimasu.
Goodbye.